TV and judiciary Monday, April 7th. 1975, 8 a.m. room 4078. Work session on 35, 75, 76, 81, 206, 240, 387, 473, 501, 509, 560, 581, 623, 627, 631, 664, 753, 763!
Did you have some amendments on this?
Yes. Caldwell. Did you have those things?
No, I don't.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was me.
Well, you just one word, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Somewhere in that letter, I thought you wrote them out. Maybe on the bill itself. Yeah, it's in the bill over. I think you wrote it out there.
You broadened it to all motions or something.
Yes.
Yeah, I do it all motions.
Yeah.
On the
one. That's all I wrote. I wrote
none of the
amendments.
His amendment is just in line 13, after the comma, you would delete the rest of the line and also delete line 14, so that the new language would read, when the defendant has appeared, all motions must be served upon him except, number one, motions.
Next party motion.
Regarding orders setting times for appearance or hearing, and two, when the court determines that immediate action without notice is desirable in the interest of justice.
Who's the amendment? Caldwell. He was the one that requested the bill, so I'll move those amendments.
The amendment was made by Mr.
Move it out.
Are we all satisfied with the form? All right, I'll move it out.
Hello. 3 second explanation of that for Wally.
Yeah, my this came to my attention. Caldwell was an Oregon City lawyer, wrote me some time ago, and had a peculiar example of it, and he testified before the committee 10 days ago or so, and if I were
that's a problem.
Yeah, I think if I recall correctly, and John can probably help me, but it was an example that assumes that if the defendant does not appear, of course he's in default. But in some cases where the defendant has appeared, instituted an answer, and then the answer might have been struck on a juror or a motion. And a certain time given to plead over. Apparently, in an instance, he did not plead over, and usually the practice among lawyers, as I understand it, is when the defendant has made an appearance and you're about to make a default for failure to further plead, you would get a notice that you're going in with your motion to default. But technically, when the answer was stricken and he had 10 days, and 10 days came and went, one could argue that he no longer had an answer. He was then in default. Apparently, a fellow moved in and put a motion in an order and took a default judgment against him, even though he had originally made an appearance. After some legal tussle, he was able to unravel it, if I recall, and have the motion and order vacated and go in and put his answer.
That also could happen, where the defendant had simply filed a motion to strike, for example, and there's nothing in. I think then, after the ruling, even though he hadn't put in an answer or anything, this would require notice in every event. And many of us have thought that if you had an appearance, they couldn't get this without notice, but that apparently is not the law.
That's what he's getting at. There's kind of, an unwritten code among most lawyers that once there's been an appearance, you don't move without giving notice to the lawyer on the other side. But apparently there's no statutory requirement, and that's what he was getting at, if I understand. Thank you very much. I think that we've not had that problem in Marion County.
Well, I've had that sort of thing happen to me, even when there was agreement to the contrary.
See? Okay. I'll move it out. I'll see you in a minute.
Did you want to add anything, John?
No, let him go.
Make the motion that is passed and go out to the community. Lisa, Walter Brown.
Aye.
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 You know, what happened to me one time, I had this one lawyer. We had an agreement he wouldn't take a default in one case. Then he took a default, an oral agreement. So the next time I said, never again, I'll put it in writing. And I put it in writing and did it again.
Get it in blood next time.
Yeah. Yes.
A bill that was carried when I wasn't here, but if I understand the problem, evidently there were some grandparents who were not able to get to see their grandchild, and that was the problem that gave rise to this bill. This bill would provide for a court allowing for visitation rights to persons having an interest in the welfare of minor children pending a divorce decree or a separation decree at the time that the decree is issued or subsequent to the decree where it might, one party might seek to modify it.
Because I think they would.
I think so, yeah.
It's good bill of time. Madam Chairman, you know, there's another question I've never put a bill in on. This would be an appropriate vehicle for you. There is a real serious difficulty, I think, where you have visitation rights, and one party or the other is refusing to provide support. And under the present law, you can't refuse, of course, your visitation simply because the other person hasn't supported them. On the other hand, people think that you ought to be able to in most cases, and it is often very unfair, especially where reciprocals are involved. That's another problem. It's very unfair, I think, for, it's usually the wife, to refuse to allow the husband to visit the child and just give him pure hell. And yet come after him in court to collect support money. And I know I had this come up in a reciprocal one time before Judge Lennon, and he claims that in Multnomah County, Judge Lewis has attempted to improve upon the law, but in effect said that unless there was some reasonable arrangement for visitation, that he would
attempted somehow to foul up the reciprocal thing. Now, there's two problems here. It seems to me that a judge should have the authority to say that visitation privileges may be restricted if the parent who has the responsibility of support is capable of providing support and willfully fails and refuses to provide the support of the child. Now, this would be a bill that we could do that. Another part of the problem, maybe John could check this out, is on these reciprocals. Again, the reciprocal, when you get one of those, and if you're, let's say you have a client who lives here in Oregon, and their spouse is, and I had one the other day where the spouse of the kids was a man, by the way, but then their spouse is in another state, and they come in here, you're totally defenseless on anything except money. They come in here and ask for support. They can't raise the question of right to visitation or anything else. They have no jurisdiction over them. They're just helpless. You're stripped of your defenses when a reciprocal comes in here from another state on support. And again, it seems to me we should do something about that. That's just so patently unfair.
Well,
this is not Walt like that.
No.
Walt's name on it. So
you would have no reason to not to pack that in here. If it could be done, within the confines of the
exception.
Well, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that if the court finds that they have the capability of support, but then they refuse to do so, that visitation might be denied them. I agree with you. I don't think that that a person simply because he's incapable of supporting a child should be denied visitation. But if you've got a person, as I've seen, who has a perfectly good job, and they just give put the person through all sorts of hell and just don't regularly provide support money.
It does actually
Well, you're saying that this is kind of a half parent, that he has the obligation to support, but then he has no obligation to be a parent to that child by being able to see the child. So, as I say, I was running, and Judge Lewis, I think it was Lennon or one of the others that pointed this out, people who are involved, and I haven't personally been involved in this as a litigant, but people who are involved really feel very strongly on both directions. And I think they're right. I think it's just grossly unfair to require one to provide child support and yet not be in a position to require the spouse who has the custody to be decent about allowing visitation.
You want to hold this up while you just add that on? Are you prepared? Do you have a proof?
Well, now, I think this legislation is questionable, actually. Anyhow, really, I think it does have quite an interesting policy question. Are we going to extend to grandparents legal rights of visitation, which they don't have now, and as far as I know, never have had, unless the and this proposes to extend the right to grandparents. I say that's a new concept.
No, I don't think that. I think grandparents for a child are the greatest thing.
I just feel with
grandparents for a child. I think I don't think a policy question. It's not a legal question. Have it done.
Well, the policy is
Are we going to give Curtis, there can be some awfully mean grandparents too, you know.
I never knew it.
This just gives the court jurisdiction. Is that all it really does? It doesn't necessarily give the grandparents the visitation right, but it gives the court the right to allow visitation to. Well, that isn't, as long as it's with the court, but if we could add the provision in here that would give to the court also the authority to order the stay of support where there's a finding that the parent having the custody is willfully preventing the supporting parent from being extended the right to visitation. Willfully preventing the finding by the court that the support, that the parent with the custody is willfully preventing or not allowing the supporting parent to have reasonable visitation rights with the child. They can't. I'm telling you, the law now does not give the court that authority.
I wouldn't have believed
it. Bring a show cause, and so what happens? And then they bring another show cause, and so then another show cause, and they still don't get to see
it.
I say you stop the support. Stop the support.
Oh, I wouldn't.
Well, it's all very well to say that when no one hasn't been in that position, but I'd like to have us bring in some of these husbands that have been, and it's not unusual, who've had a wife that's just determined that that husband is not going to see those kids under any circumstance. And they just won't allow them to see them, call them up something serious.
Mm.
And I say it's even worse than the reciprocal where you have an out-of-state thing. And I think sometimes that's probably why they go out of state, is to prevent visitation. Go out of state and come in for support for the child, and yet will not make any arrangements to allow the supporting parents to see the children.
Chairman, this is the bill that we discussed the last work meeting that has the support of the Oregon Bar as well as the sponsors on the bill. It's basically designed to encourage marketability of title to real property where title has been conveyed via a land sale contract. Currently, if there is a land sales contract, the seller retains legal title to the property until the purchaser makes all of the payments under the contract. If subsequent to the contract, a creditor of the seller obtains a judgment against him, that creditor has a lien against the title to the property that has been conveyed via the land sales contract. And because of that, or that particular lien creates a cloud on the title, and the purchaser cannot very easily sell the land, nor is the purchaser really able to continue making payments to the seller, because if he does do that, he does it at his peril. If he's aware of the lien he pays to the seller, he may also be held liable to the judgment creditor. So this bill would simply say that once the land sales contract has been recorded, the purchaser's interest in the property will take priority to any subsequent judgment creditor against the seller. No, it doesn't.
Well, aren't there some amendments too? I hope there is amendments too. Madam Chairman, let me see if I can get this clear. Now, under the present law, isn't it a fact that up to a point at least, the buyer is considered to be an equitable conversion? The buyer's interest is then superior to that of the subsequent lien snore, and as a matter of fact, the lien does not attach to the buyer's interest.
That was the case in, say, a 1963 Oregon Supreme Court case. They refused to apply the doctrine of equitable conversion and said that the seller retained legal title, and consequently the lien on the title took priority over the purchaser's equitable interest in the land.
Even on a recorded interest?
No.
It took priority over the purchaser?
You could say even an unrecorded?
Even in the case of a recorded contract.
Yeah.
You're saying that the lienor did not come in and take an interest superior to the vendee.
Yeah. The way this arose was in this way. The purchaser refused to continue making payments under the contract, and as a result of that, the seller foreclosed on the property. And went to reject the purchaser. The purchaser went to court, and it was determined that the purchaser did not have to continue to make payments because there was a cloud on title, that is, the lien of this judgment creditor against the seller, and that the seller had to make the title clear, or the purchaser would not have to continue making payments.
Go ahead. Let me take a look.
Well,
I'm not going to vote for something if I don't know what I'm doing.
This really is a great protection to the contract purchaser of land, and oftentimes the individual with limited financial ability can really only arrange to obtain land through this mechanism. But he does so at his peril. If the seller of the land doesn't keep his financial affairs in order, because this lien can attack and destroy, in effect, the equitable interest of the purchaser. This becomes a cloud that they're concerned about, because once the purchase is completed and the vendor gives title, he also likes to give title to the bank. As long as there's the lien outstanding, really that title is not free and clear.
Yeah, well,
it's a great piece of legislation from a consumer standpoint.
Well, I let me read this, but I just think that John made a mistake here. I don't, and I'm going to read this note here. It doesn't seem to me that this says that the right of a vendee is can be washed out by a judgment creditor.
Can you walk around?
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
Wally, I'm opposing this because I don't think that it does what some of the, with all due respect to the sponsors and counsel, what they say it does. And I want to, I'm not voting for it at the moment, and I appreciate your support until we find out what in the hell it does. I mean, what the law really is. And I believe it's been represented to us that, innocently, I'm sure, that that currently, and I want to read the case, that's all I want to do before voting on it, it's been represented to us that a judgment creditor obtaining the judgment subsequent to the sale can cut off the interest of the buyer who has a recorded interest in a land sale contract. And I don't think that's what this says.
It becomes a lien on it.
Well, it becomes a lien, but it's on the vendor's interest, isn't it?
That's right. And
the vendor's
and
interest.
And then there comes a time. Here's what happens. You have a contract of sale, and, you know, lots of times not recorded. So there is many, many times no way for that vendee to even know if somebody has gotten a judgment against the vendor.
Well, let's get
that's
this.
That's one thing. Okay, so the judgment is docketed against the vendor, and of course it becomes a lien on his legal interest.
Right.
Okay, now then there are two problems. One is when it comes time to make a transfer, there is this lien. Now you have to, you can handle it if at that time you can find the vendor, and if you can get a release of the judgment, or if you can bring a quiet title suit, or, you know, these hippies. But it's expensive. It's very expensive to clean that up. And actually, what we're trying to provide is that the judgment creditor can get the contract interest, which really is all the vendor has coming to it, the right to receive the money. But under the law, he also has the legal title. So that's one problem, that it creates a cloud on the title, and there's just this, you know, easy way. Well, it's just an added expense. You see your preliminary title report, and it will have these judgments docketed. Well, then you've got to start cleaning up or getting the papers or bringing a quiet title suit or something. So that's one problem. On the other hand, here you have a vendee who is in the position of paying at his peril. You know, if he is paying to the vendor at a time when the judgment creditor of the vendor has the right to receive that money, then the wrong guy is getting the money. Are you with me?
Well, you're...
And so if this passes, then as soon as that thing is... as soon as your contract of sale is recorded, then the judgment creditor of the vendor is protected. The vendor is off the hook as far as clouding up the title is concerned. The vendee knows who's paid. And so it's just a stuffy little problem that has cost quite a little bit of money in litigation, and this straightens it out.
Well, it's that last statement of yours that I have doubts about.
Well,
I'm not arguing with any of the rest of it. I just want to follow through how it is said that this happened. I just don't, I frankly don't understand, or it doesn't, I have not been convinced that it does what you say it does, the way you say it does it.
what I'm saying, let me try to go through the detail.
Okay.
First of all, tell me if this is a correct statement or not. The vendee in a land sale contract, where the contract is recorded, now that's the first thing, where it is recorded, the vendee has an interest that is not subject to a judgment obtained and or docketed after the recording of the contract of sale. His interest, his equity in that land is superior to the judgment creditor of the vendor.
It would be if you cast the sale.
Well, now it is, isn't it? You say it is not.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I want to see. I don't think you're right. I don't think that's what this says. It says the doctrine of equitable conversion will not be applied in such a manner as to prevent a judgment rendered against the vendor from becoming a lien against his interest in the property being sold under a land sale contract. That is the vendor's interest.
It says the doctrine of equitable conversion will not be applied.
Right. Against the vendor's interest.
If it were applied, then the only thing the vendor has coming to him is a contract.
And it goes on, nor will it impose a judgment against the vendee as a lien against the vendee's interest.
That's right, and that's we're also trying to correct. Because actually the vendee is the owner of the land, but you can't get to it. The vendor is not the owner of the land, but you can get to it. So that's the thing.
Well, I mean, maybe we ought to change the law, but I stated a proposition that I think is contrary to what you just said.
Well, assuming that the law is as you say,
yes.
Then this bill
is totally unnecessary.
Would be unnecessary, but at least it has the effect of reducing the common law to the statute form. You object to the
I don't object to what they say is happening, probably, but I'm just questioning whether it does that.
Madam Chairman,
yes.
The only interest that we're really concerned about is the interest of the vendor, and that is his interest in the legal title to the property. And
well, he has more than
the interest in the legal title to the property is a security interest to assure that he gets the payments under the land sale contract. The legal title doesn't transfer to the vendee. Stays with the vendor. Now that security interest in the legal title is the thing that we're talking about and which is subject to the lien of a judgment creditor against the vendor.
Right.
And whenever that is subject to that lien, there arises a cloud on the title to the property.
And shouldn't it be that way? If you're going to have judgment lien, I own a piece of property. You sue me. After I've sold to Senator Brown.
You've got legal title,
I've got legal title, he has equitable title. I sell it to him for $20,000. Between the time that, maybe it's one day or maybe it's 5 years, between the time that I sell it to him and the time that a judgment is obtained against me, he has developed an equity of $5,000. I still have a $15,000 seller's interest in that property. You obtain a judgment against me. Why shouldn't you be able to go against my legal title after notifying him? Now that's a question, I don't know if it's true. After notifying him, I have a judgment against Cook. Cook has $15,000 you owe Cook. I have a judgment against Cook. I've recorded it. Therefore, you pay either me or me and Cook. Why isn't that
reasonable? You still have that. Your interest in the contract, to the payments under the contract, is still subject to my lien. We're talking about only your interest in the legal title, which is a security interest to make sure the payments come forward. Under this bill, the judgment creditor would still to be able to execute his lien on your contract rights to the payment.
But it was, it would not be, would it be a judgment lien against the legal title?
It would not be a lien against legal title. It would be a lien against your contract right to the payment.
Or would it be a lien at all? Would it be a lien? Or would it simply be the right to garnish that contract? There are no prepared amendments, Madam Chairman. This is a bill that was prepared by the Department of Transportation. And it would allow the department to, through regulations, define conduct which would justify expulsion of an individual from public transportation facility. That is defined in the bill in section 2. And it would make that a violation of those regulations a Class C misdemeanor. That would be
the
first major change to make. The second change would be to amend the crime of offensive littering to include discarding debris in or upon a public transportation facility. And the last amendment would be to amend the crime of criminal mischief to make it a crime to damage property of any public transportation facility. This would be a Class C felony.
Madam Chairman, I move we table Senate Bill 627. That's the reason I won't move the table up.
It's a combination of 3 and 5. Yeah, I would, Madam Chairman, I wouldn't support it in the present sense, and I was tending to vote with Vern, but I wanted everybody to have an opportunity to see if we could make something out of this. But the combination of 3 and 5 is devastating, and I'd
Section 7, can we tell we're going to get on that?
The Department of Transportation, that is it.
The thing we're having clean bus stations and buses.
Well, I don't suppose there's anything too wrong with Section 7. It just extends this apparently to public transportation facilities, which I suppose would be a TriMet. I don't know, public utility or railroad, and I suppose what else is there? Bus stop?
Bus stop, bus station. For essentially a I think that's a good extension, but
to the airline?
Yeah.
I suppose,
we'll have to pick up the definition, because it refers to 164805, we're not changing that.
So to the question whether you really, that statute 164365 is all that good or not, isn't there, aren't there other alternative descriptions of that?
This is most serious. There are 3 degrees of criminal mischief, first, second, and third. This is the most serious.
Was this part of the criminal code?
Yes, it is.
John, Section 2 says it's only applicable to Section 2 and 3. Wouldn't it also be applicable to Section 7? It's a fast reading.
Yeah, I'd say you could do it there. They seemingly provided for that on page 4, lines 7 and 8.
I see.
Oh,
again,
while I'm new to federal development, Section 7, that we change the definition of public transportation to what we have.
Right. I'm just trying to see how Section 2 and fits into that. So, John points out over on page 3, we've got the public transportation facility defined, so I gather that covers the. What is that definite? That's 164.805. Is that adequate?
No. The best thing to do would be to amend Section 7 to simply add a
definition.
Yeah, simply under C, simply add the definition of public transportation facility as it appears in Section 2.
Right.
Just move quick.
No more cigar questionnaires. You have a stewardess from Northwest Fuel Law.
67.
Madam Chairman, this was set for a hearing and no one appeared to testify on behalf of it. The changes which it makes are as follows. First of all, in on page 2, line 12, it deletes the maximum period for which somebody may have a sentence imposed or a sentence suspended. And it doesn't place any maximum period for the suspension of the sentence. Down on in line 17 and 18, it authorizes the court to order a compromise agreement to be entered into by the victim as well as the perpetrator of the crime for compensation for damages. This would be a condition of the suspended sentence. Section 2 down over on page 3 lays out the provisions relating to this compromise agreement. Tells what the court should consider in ordering a compromise and how the payments may be made. What action can be taken to the court by the court if the order of the court is not complied with.
John, I do not understand what I
are you compromising the fence? That's the terminology we use.
Currently, there is. I don't particularly understand this language in this bill, but there are provisions under existing statutes whereby a misdemeanor charge can be compromised. And the way that is done is that normally the person charged with the crime or his attorney will approach the victim of the crime and offer to make restitution for the damages that the victim has suffered, if it's an assault for medical expenses, things like that, if it's a crime involving destruction or damage to property for whatever the cost of repair is. These two parties will enter into a written agreement, and they bring that agreement to the court. And the court has the authority of either accepting their agreement or rejecting it completely. If the court rejects it, the charge is continued against the defendant and prosecuted just as if it normally would. There was no compromise involved. If the court accepts the compromise, then the court is authorized to dismiss the charge subject to the successful execution of the compromise. I believe the statute also provides that the compromise agreement has to have been completed before the court actually considers it and possibly dismisses the charge. There's no such provision under the existing law applicable to felonies. This is not exactly, the wording does not accomplish that. The wording in this bill would apply only where the court contemplates suspending a sentence through the imposition or execution of a sentence. It seems to say that the court can order an agreement to be made between the parties, which I'm not so sure agreement is the proper term for that. I think under the existing...
Order restitution, in other words.
Yeah. Under the existing law, I think that the court can order restitution now for damages.
Without additional statutory authority.
Yes, and it can also say if it orders that as a condition of a suspended sentence, if it's not complied with, it can act upon that. If you had ordered to show cause why, say, the sentence should not be executed.
If our current law provides for the goal which this legislation seeks to release,
I think so, unless I'm missing the point of the bill.
Both misdemeanors and felonies?
Yes.
If it doesn't seem anything happen, it's a plain. I hate to table Senator Burley's new bill without concerning with him, but it's the best. Advice we have is that it doesn't do anything. I wouldn't want to move it out. I'll quickly use Senator Bruce.
Right,
Emily,
we
No.
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 No. Wayne, what's wrong with you?
You've got 5601 for what that's
going on. Okay, 25601.
There are no amendments. There was vigorous opposition to the bill by some people. Those speaking for the bill were Senator Whipple and Mr. James Baker. The opponents were Ward Cook, representing the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association, Richard Hendry, representing the Oregon Savings and Loan League, Dean Boise, representing the First National Bank of Oregon, and Donald Dunn, who was just here on another bill and expressed his reservations about section 4 of the bill. The first three opponents suggested that the bill be tabled or the committee do nothing with it.
Lynn, do you want to say anything?
This is my understanding based on our previous discussion with Senator Whipple that if a purchaser of land who has a mortgage, even mortgage deed, finds someone to buy the land from him and assume the obligations of the mortgage. Under this bill, the original mortgagee, the original owner of the land, still remains liable under that mortgage contract.
That's correct. The original maker of the note, the lender still has recourse to the original maker of the note.
And he has recourse to the land.
Hasn't this been used by some lending institutions to require an increase in the amount of interest, to require prepayment, and then...
Senator Cook, it's been used primarily by the lenders to... It's been used primarily by the lenders to keep control of the property in terms of future sales. They pursue a variety of different assumption procedures, which I think Senator Carson knows have imposed a number of real estate transactions. And some of them have very small assumption costs. Others will charge you 1% of the original amount of the mortgage. Others will just flat out refuse to allow you, without their permission, to sell a property on the basis of an assumption. And in essence, they control the property rather than the individual. And this bill is designed to indicate that you can sell your property on an assumption basis and that they can charge you their actual cost plus an additional $100. It also, the latter part of the bill directs itself to make certain that on prepayment penalties, most lenders now have some rather serious prepayment penalties, and they're not carefully discussed with the purchaser at the time that he enters into the mortgage. And then 3, 4, 5 years down the line, when it comes time to resell, he's faced with, say, a 3% prepayment penalty. This bill does not prohibit that prepayment penalty, but it very specifically states that it's got to be upfront, that the individual's got to be completely and totally aware of what he's getting himself into on the prepayment penalty. Now, I know a lot of the lenders probably would be happier with this bill if it were restricted only to single family residents rather than to the large commercial properties. And I might be amenable to that sort of an amendment, feeling that the large commercial developers have an ability to deal with the lenders that the average homeowner does not. However, I put it in feeling that it really was appropriate for the entire spectrum.
You don't really suggest that we make that
change. No, I don't, but that is a suggestion I'm sure that has been made to you because following the hearing, several of the lenders suggested to me that that's one of the things they were going to talk to the committee about.
Any questions?
Where in the bill does it say that the original mortgage remains liable under the mortgage contract?
So I don't have the feel in front of me, but that is a normal procedure on any assumption. The original maker of the note,
it is common law.
Common law is responsible for it. The only way that he is, but there is a provision which can be employed where he is not, but that involves additional negotiation between the buyer, seller, and lender at the point in time of sale.
He leaves from the
right.
On a novation,
What is the basic objection now of the industry to this?
Well, the basic objection is that they're going to lose some of the control that they presently have over property that they have mortgages. Number one, and number two, they're not going to be able to charge as much as they presently are if this bill is passed for a loan assumption.
How do they lose control?
The way many of the mortgages are written now is that you may not sell on an assumption without paying a large fee, which makes it impossible for a lot of people to buy on an assumption basis because of the increased cost. And secondly, many of the mortgages and trustees that are written today specifically prohibit the sale on an assumption basis without the express written permission of the person holding the mortgage.
But, what problems might arise? Are there any legitimate reasons why a lendor might want to restrict the transfer of the property?
Well, the reasons they give, I don't find valid. The reason they give is that they have no knowledge or background of the individual who is assuming the mortgage. However, I think that is negated by the fact that the original maker of the note is ultimately responsible for it, number one. Number two, on an assumption, the individual purchasing usually has to have a significant equity position to buy down to and assume that loan, and therefore, to me, has indicated a degree of financial responsibility.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
What would you think if we were to restrict this legislation to residential properties containing two or less units, let's say? I'm trying to think of a duplex. So that we'd say that this legislation would be restricted to a duplex or smaller. If in fact they are paying that much attention, I can see where if you... Let's say I were operating a hardware store, and I borrowed the money to operate that hardware store out in a new development, or an old development someplace, any development. And it could be important to the lendor that I continue to operate, or be responsible for the management of that building.
I would feel better to cook more comfortable if you were to limit it to four or less. The reason I say four is that the federal VA allows an owner-occupant to buy up to a fourplex. And so you have a number, you have large numbers of individuals who are owning fourplexes and living in them. So this still becomes a fourplex. As much as a fourplex still can be considered, I think, along the single-family approach.
I would move, Madam Chairman, that we restrict the operation of this bill upon those loans involving fourplexes or less, as indicated by Senator Whipple, with appropriate language to be figured out.
Second,
yes.
Let's call
this.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Aye. Madam Chairman, I think this is going in the right direction, but I confess I'm just not sufficiently up on it. I'd like to, no one from the industry talked to me at all. I missed the hearing, I got the first part of it, and that may be unusual, but they have not yet sought me out. I'd like the opportunity to talk to Senator Whipple about this before I vote aye. I think there may be enough votes to vote aye anyway. I don't suggest holding it up, but there are fine. But I want to explain my no vote ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
Aye. No.
Aye.
No.
Let's take a look at 631 again. Yeah. Walt Brown's bill, the primary purpose of student education rights to grandparents, state and person.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
Before some of the members were here, I was discussing the possibility of using this bill as a vehicle to provide that, in addition to the authority suggested here, that a court should have the authority to stay the obligation of paying child support if the court makes the finding that the custodial spouse is intentionally refusing to allow the supporting spouse the visitation provided for in the decree of divorce. The reason I suggested that, I've run into it many times, and I imagine the other faction lawyers have run into it frequently, that you'll have a situation where the person who has the kid just goes out of their way to allow this person, usually a man, or it could be the other, to have reasonable visitation. And most people feel that's extremely unfair. I happen to think it's unfair, too. I recognize there's a difference that we brought the child into the world, and therefore, all other things being equal, that we have an obligation to support that child, you know, rather than public welfare. I would require a finding by the court that this has been done before the, that's going pretty restrictive. Finding by the court that the custodial spouse has intentionally refused reasonable visitation as provided under the decree to the supporting spouse.
What difference would it make then whether it's written into the law or not? Because the practice now is that you go into court on an affidavit to show that the person is not getting visitation rights, and usually the delinquent in paying the child support and or she brings the action and want for payment, his defense is that there's been no visitation and it's all heard before the court anyway.
It's not a legal defense, and it would not be a basis for avoiding a contempt citation. I've had judges tell me frequently in this kind of a case, and also, and the other one was a reciprocal case where this was involved, and I think the reciprocal would be affected by this. I've had Judge Lennon told me on a reciprocal from another state, and I think this might be involved, where they came in here and they sought support, who says, we have no authority, there's nothing in the law, and there are cases to the contrary, to refuse to allow the support simply because the custodial spouse refuses to honor the visitation provision. Yeah, without authority.
Well, I sure Spring's concern and has been a great point of irritation between the parties. In fairness, I suppose you'd ought to work, one would work the other way, and that is that if you don't pay your support, you don't get visitation now.
That's fair enough.
Well, I think the point is, if we're down to the basic support formula, and what I mean by that is that it's the people were hurting the kids,
yeah.
And that's the thing. In other words, you get a rotten wife who deprives the custodial wife, deprives the former husband's father of the right to see his children, so he then, by virtue of our proposal here, would then be able to cut off support. And the one you're really crippling is the child.
Well, I'm suggesting to avoid that. And we could do it two ways. I think that's fine. The parent who refuses to support when there's a finding that he's able, financially able to support, but has intentionally refused to. On the other hand, where there's a finding by the court that the custodial spouse has intentionally refused to allow the supporting spouse to visit the children, that the court will have discretion
that'd be my discretion, to restrict visitation rights or to modify support requirements on that ground and for that reason.
Well, Vern, I wanted to make it a Class C misdemeanor.
Well, that doesn't help any.
That's not a real motion.
No.
No. No.
Aye.
Robert.
Aye.
Well, I like the idea, but I don't know.
No.
Do you have a suggestion?
No, I don't. Make it some sort of penalty. If you're fine with me, I'd go for a penalty, but I don't.
How about this approach then? I would move that this bill be amended to provide that the court shall, well, I don't know if they already have that, but I'm afraid they already have that authority to hold them in contempt of court. So you're really not getting anywhere that way with them. Now, never mind on that. You're not getting anywhere that way, and you're helpless in a reciprocal. Because they're not here.
Put it on the rack.
There's a lot of it, you know. There's a lot of it, very unjust.
When you figure out a penalty that doesn't deprive the child, then I'll work for it.
Well, as a practical matter, I think you'd find that if the money were held up, you'd get more reasonable action.
Well, no doubt.
Welfare is that's the problem.
Bill is sponsored by Senator Meeker, and what it would do would require that whenever a state health officer or a physician indicates to the Motor Vehicles Division that a person is afflicted with a mental or physical infirmity or disability, rendering it unsafe for that person to drive a motor vehicle, rather than allowing the Motor Vehicles Division to suspend that person's right to drive, they would require, before the Motor Vehicles Division do that corroborating evidence be supplied by another physician. The Motor Vehicles Division was submitted written testimony in opposition to the bill from the standpoint that the suspension may be delayed indefinitely, pending, say, this corroborating evidence. There is an amendment that has been proposed by legislative counsel. It should be in your packet. I don't believe that this amendment solves the problem of the motor vehicle division.
Well,
you think
that the appropriate amendment
is
to put a time limit on obtaining a second
season? I don't think that's going to solve the motor vehicle's problem, because there's no way in which they can force, say, somebody to come in with this corroborating evidence. There's no position whereby they could, say, have at least the bill as drafted doesn't provide any way in which they can compel somebody to submit to an examination so that they would get this corroborating evidence. And so even if you put this time limit in, still there's going to,
the matter is going to...
That's, I think, would do the job.
Wasn't there some proposal, John, that the corroboration be from a medical doctor collected by the state health officer?
I don't know. Again, this was the Monday that I was not at the hearing.
Some of the cases that the other motor vehicle department can have some role in selecting that position.
They do indicate in their written comments that they're concerned about a person who is subject to suspension under their stopping for a physician who might give them a favorable report. So they may well have suggested that the cooperating physician be appointed by the motor vehicle physician and come from a state institution.
I have reservations about the bill maintaining and the way it operates. And six doctors' report would be taken by a motor vehicle company, doesn't say that yet. So if they differ, which one are they going to take? The first one or the second one will require surgery.
Subsection 2, we're going to have to insert their certificated school counselor to allow for a waiver of the privilege if the student takes a stand. That's
so
not provided.
Is this a staff counselor instead of member?
No. There's, if you look at paragraph I on page 3, it refers to a certificated staff member, which is a separate privilege. So you would have to also insert certificated school counselor to cover that waiver possibility.
Wait a minute, John, are we changing that from so that it's only a counselor now and no other members?
No, it would still be, there would still be the privilege attaching to the certificated staff member.
We've got staff member down in line 9 too.
Right.
Is that all right?
Yes, that's a separate privilege there in I.
Is there a
question
for the member?
There's some question as to whether you really had a certificated school counselor. They're really teachers, not certificated as a teacher, I guess, rather than as a counselor. And so it seemed that there was some suggestion in the testimony that we strike the word certificated on line 15. And then down on line 20, you add the word 15 before the word certification. So I have those in my notes. A proposed amendment by people who testify.
I don't have that. The only person that that may well have come up in the committee discussion, though.
Yeah,
Madam Chairman, the concern I have is that this bill goes a long way to solving the problem we've had for the last 6 years or so, and that is school counselor. There is no designation of school counselor. So now you have a certified school, in other words, I covers everybody. Now you give them a new title. A certificated school is the same thing as a certificated staff member, in my view. They've added the word counselor, which is kind of superfluous because the counselor's in the eye of the beholder. In other words, you're anointed by the principal, makes you the counselor. The major difference is, of course, is that it's a broader authority than you have under the certificated staff member, as I understand it. It picks up criminals. I was brought in to keep the counselor out of the domestic relations squabbles 2 years ago or 4 years ago. Now Jay is being brought in so that this extends to the counselor the same authority that a lawyer might have or a priest might have in not divulging competencies. My concern is that the bill goes a long way to making it more palatable to me than it has been years past, but I think we're building an area of confidentiality upon sand, and that is that we have no original duty to a school counselor and what their functions are, what their duties are, and what their relationships with children are, and yet we're providing them with this rather very broad, authority not to a requirement not to test copies. I just have strong misgivings. It's a very tough area, and so I'm for a little help. Well, we didn't, but we chose not to.
Yes.
The answer is yes, no.
Is it 509?
Madam Chairman, that would change subsection 1 to read as follows. The Legislative Assembly hereby declares that the interpretation of federal legislation regarding unlawful practices based on race, religion, color, national origin, or sex shall be persuasive in the interpretation of ORS 659020 and 659022. That's a policy. As to the legal effect, I don't think it has any great legal effect at all.
Mr. Ward, do you want to address that?
I'm careful, sir, since I mentioned my testify, one of the problems the Bureau has in processing complaints, of course, is the law that we apply. Level of affiliation, and further in the level of adherence, may well be federal law. There's an abundance of federal law in their own areas to arrest. If the case goes beyond the hearing to the court, the Oregon court, the practice today is generally the Georgian court has not even referred to or considered the federal question. We feel it would help us a great deal if this would happen, as the desire, like the accused out of 509.
Yeah, you probably covered it, and I apologize for asking again, but has it been an affirmative, and I presume the department has raised the issue, has cited the various authorities, raised it, and the court has chosen not to follow that, apparently. However, have they stated affirmatively they choose to do their own thing, or have they taken the federal law, have they ignored it, or have they distinguished it? I guess it would be the best way to ask.
My understanding in consultation with the AG's office that there is the contract ignored.
If you'll move the amendment to 509, that the court should find the federal decision to serve. I wanted to ask you to do that.
Madam Chairman? Madam
Chairman?
Is
that a delegation
of the police? Really not a delegation of legislative power, I don't think. Stepped into the area of what the court can do.
Madam Chairman? Doesn't the local court currently have this authority? And they can look at these and be persuaded.
Yeah.
On the other hand, they may think it's illegal.
This is what point is not.
Or they're certainly not. Well, that's the question I was trying to get at. Are they looking at it and not being persuaded? And then I think if that's the case, we run a very questionable constitutional court if we say we want you to make those persuasions. If they refuse to look at it, that's a different point. I don't know how much difference, but it's...
And actually, wouldn't it be unconstitutional for us to try to do what is being suggested if it really did have any effect? Because we don't know what we're about.
I do consider
it. Well, it's advised.
No, it ought to be a joint resolution.
Well, the amendment is required to make it the place that we're accepting the amendment.
Thank you.
And it's first time we're going to
No.
Pardon?
No. Abstain.
Robert? Aye.
Don't waste too much time coming over.
Are there amendments to 81?
No amendments, Madam Chairman.
Nice.
Section 1, as I understand it, attempts to get at property held by a person who has received general assistance and whose estate is in or under a conservatorship. the language in subsection 2 of section 1 is somewhat inconsistent with the language in section 1. If you look at the language that begins on line 12 and runs through line 15, provides that there can't be any recovery of general assistance paid except after the death of the individual who received that assistance and his surviving spouse. Subsection 2 would seem to indicate that that language is applicable only so long as a person's estate is not under a conservatorship. Once it comes under a conservatorship, then the welfare division, if Section 1 is enacted, would be able to move against the estate under conservatorship.
Wait a minute, here's welfare. You want to say anything about it?
Essentially, all this is trying to do is to give the public welfare division a claim in a conservatorship. We don't now have a claim in a conservatorship. We would be able to close a lot of existing conservatorships if we could file a claim, and existing conservatorships where the only income is maybe Social Security or payment from a asset under the contract. Bill Dobson, Public Welfare Division.
Sorry, go ahead.
And it would permit the conservatorship to be closed by us filing a claim in it. And in those cases, the funds would be placed in trust and agency for the use of the deficient sponsor on public assistance.
Madam Chair, the existing law under sections 1, 2, and 3 provides that the welfare division cannot bring a claim against an estate while the recipient is still living. The effect of the amendments to those three sections would allow the welfare division to bring a claim against an estate under conservatorship. That's one of the main changes made. Section 4 involves 414.105. You see, there's no requirement there, or there's no provision there that a claim cannot be made while the recipient is alive. It simply says that on page 4, line 5, beginning on line 5, there shall be no adjustment of recovery thereof until after the death of the surviving spouse. It doesn't mention the death of the recipient. So that particular section is different from the three preceding sections.
Now that section applies to which parts of welfare assistance? What kind?
It's medical assistance.
Excuse me, John, but 414.105 currently just gives a claim in the estate of a deceased recipient. We don't have a claim where there's a surviving spouse.
I'll
be fine.
I want to know if anyone wanted to ask any questions.
I'll send a motion to pass the bill out to be passed.
And Brown moves any welfare bill 81 out to be passed. Discussion? Quick call roll.
Aye.
Aye. Abstain.
Robert.
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, so many, this is a bill that we've heard on several occasions, and I was going to do this. There were three things that concerned me, and I apparently only one was stayed me with me with such a concern that stayed with me long enough to work on it. I talked to Dr. 11 and several other people about the provision. John can help me find it, but toward the back, but it's on page 8, starting on line 20, that would allow the mental health division to release somebody after he'd served the maximum term in the state mental hospital, or 5 years, whichever is less. And that is to say that if the maximum term was 5 years, they'd hold him for 5 years. It's kind of my shorthand way of saying it would be this law would presume that if he spent 5 years in mental health, that's the most severe penalty he would have spent had he been convicted. The four less is what bothered me, because there might be somebody in there for a more serious crime. I talked with Dr. 11, and he had no objection if we ran it back to the court as we do now on regular commitment proceedings, and that is to say go back to the court from whence it came, and the court would make the determination. I don't know whether, John, we can lift the language right out of the existing law.
Almost, that probably is the minor change, but I couldn't do it.
Well, that's fine with me, too, because the average stay, I understand, is 180 days. We've got a criminal insane committed crime. This house is up 180 days. Determined sane by mental health division, the court ought to have the option to put him back in jail.
Or committing him, which this counts intended.
We're talking about here not a situation where a person has been determined not guilty by reason of insanity, but rather where the person is determined not fit to proceed in trial. And it is commitment.
So that's the
continued
trial.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Did
you
do
this?
No, I have no objection.
I'll move the amendment. John, do I want to restate it?
Move it, I don't know.
I
know what.
Thank you, John. The could you pass on to the next bill and let me review it?
Madam Chairman, the representatives from the Metropolitan Youth Commission are here, and they can review the bill for the committee and also answer any questions on it.
I plan to explain this in 5 minutes, 4 minutes, if you can
Discussion.
Madam Chairman. Excuse me, you might consider whether or not in section 13 you want to make a violation of this act intentional. Currently, it would cover inadvertent violation as well as intentional.
The word violation would be intentional violation.
Madam Chairman, on the Senate Bill 240, one of the hesitations on one of my bills that was here, there was some objection raised, and I couldn't remember whether it was this one or not. Do you remember, John, whether there was any objection raised to Senate Bill 240 at the time it was here by the
Nobody was. No one testified other than yourself. I don't believe there were any objections to it.
I'd like to, if we have time to discuss it today, move on it today, or I could bring it up for next meeting. Maybe it's better to bring it up for next meeting. Could you put it on the agenda for our next meeting?
And I'm trying to get this view down, but we only can't afford it.
That's down on the military code.
Well, you do need a lot of
Well, I just want everybody to be aware, I've asked the committee to put in the Oregon Code of Military Justice, the revision of our 1961 military code.
Thank you.
Betty, would you have any one of those?